This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
Although All Our Wrong Todays is Elan Mastai's first novel, it's not his first go at telling a story. It's just a different medium. You see, Mastai comes to literature from the movie industry. He has written and produced movies such as Alone in the Dark, The Samaritan, and What If? Perhaps it's his background in film that makes All Our Wrong Todays so visually appealing, and there's not an image to be seen. Mastai set this novel in the future we were supposed to have, in a future where an engine developed by Lionel Gutrider created unlimited power, eliminating the need for fossil fuels. And it wasn't exactly an alternate future, but an alternate present. I visited with Elan Mastai the day before All Our Wrong Todays was released. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. Your protagonist, Tom Barron, is living in a world that we would consider science fiction. He describes it as Jetson-like, flying cars, moving sidewalks, robot maids. But it's not futuristic. It's 2016, but an alternative 2016. And it's a future that has deviated from the one we know, and it deviated from that future on July 11th, 1965. It was on that day that Lionel Gutrider invented the future. What happened?
Well, in the story, Lionel Gutrider is this obscure scientist who has an idea, which is that if he could invent a machine that would harness the rotation of the planet the way that a hydroelectric dam captures water falling over a waterfall. Of course, the planet orbiting in space is obviously a lot larger than a waterfall. If he could invent a way of capturing that energy of the spinning of the planet, he could revolutionize the world. Now, it's just an experiment. He doesn't even know if it's going to work, but it does. And in this version of the world, that experiment on July 11, 1965, changes the course of human history. Suddenly, instead of our dependence on fossil fuels, we have unlimited clean energy. And so human ingenuity is no longer shackled by, basically, limitations of fuel. It causes the future to play out very, very differently. So when the book starts, yeah, it's set in 2016, in the present day, but it's this other version. It's 2016, the way our grandparents, people of the post-war generation of the 1950s, it's what they thought was going to happen, how they thought the future was going to play out. And this, in the conceit of the book, it actually happened. Now, of course, through the circumstances of the plot, my main character, Tom, he ends up stealing a prototype time machine. That's one of the sort of amazing technologies that are developing in this alternate version of the world. And he goes back in time. And he causes a terrible accident, which makes a timeline in which the Gutrider engine, it never happened. The experiment failed. And panicky, he returns to the present, back to 2016, and finds himself stranded in our version of the world, what we think of as the real world, but which to him seems like this terrifying dystopia where everything has gone wrong, because this is not the way the world is supposed to be. And that's sort of the idea, fundamentally, of the book, that these dystopias, you know, that we write about in, you know, YA fiction or movies or television shows in the far-off future, no, that's not the dystopia. We're living in the dystopia right now. This isn't the way the world was supposed to be, but there's only one person that knows it, and that's my main character, Tom.
Now, listening to you, you know, give your answer, I know you have a background in films and in writing and directing or producing films, and now this is your first novel, but it's clear to me that you have a scientific background as well. Do you, or how is it that you just...
Am I just really good at faking it?
Yeah.
Well, so look, my grandfather was a chemist, scientifically trained, and childhood love of kind of old science fiction really came from him. He had this extensive collection of vintage sci-fi from the 40s and 50s and 60s. And my sort of interest in these kind of, not just the sort of the conventions of the genre, but also this sort of techno-utopian vision of the future that was sort of emblemized by this, you know, the science fiction of the era, really comes from him. But he also, you know, he was a scientist, and even though he loved sci-fi, you know, he would often grumble that, you know, these writers, if only they would just actually take the time to understand the science, the stories would actually be more interesting because they would be more real. And so I'm actually not scientifically trained. I just have a layman's understanding of this stuff, but I was really inspired by my grandfather that if I'm going to write in the genre, I have to take it as seriously as possible. So I did a lot of research. I mean, I like this stuff anyway. I'm always reading about science. I'm always kind of reading about interesting kind of new inventions or new insights or discoveries. I just like this stuff. But when I was writing the book, I did a lot of research. It's not all in the book. You know, I sort of took the principle, like, I'm only going to put what the reader needs to make the story as compelling as possible and as plausible as possible. Anything else, I mean, if people are interested, they can kind of go down a rabbit hole of research the way I did. So I did a lot more research than you read in the book, but I mean, I wanted people to feel like it was as accurate and authentic as possible because, like my grandfather said, it actually makes the story feel more real.
It really does. You know, I finished this yesterday, and since I finished the book, I've just been walking around with a smile on my face, and I'm not exactly sure what you did to make this book just so likable and fun. And, you know, I usually don't walk around with a smile on my face after I finish a book. And so you were able to make it real for me. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you for saying so. I mean, that means a lot to me. That's, you know, obviously as a writer, that's what you want. You want to have that kind of effect on people. So I'm obviously, I'm very gratified to hear that.
Now, with time travel possible in your book, you were able to alter the characteristics of your characters in a way. Tom's mother lives in the shadow of her husband's genius, but his mother in a parallel timeline is a tenured professor of literature. And one of my favorite quotes of the book is the way you describe her. You said, philosophically, she considers everyone who disagrees with her to be merely uninformed, assuming that when they have the facts, they'll understand that she was right all along. So this version of Rebecca Baron seems to be the best version of Rebecca Baron. But who's to say? I mean, was one Victor Baron better than another? And was Penelope better than Penny or vice versa? How did Tom decide which timeline was best?
Well, that's the sort of question that I was interested in exploring. I mean, obviously, look, there's all the, you know, when we open the book in this sort of alternate timeline with all this incredible technology where all of humanity's big problems, war, poverty, disease, crime, all that stuff has been solved. It doesn't mean that everybody's personal problems have been solved. I mean, there's still, you know, people still have conflict, they still have heartbreak, they still have difficult relationships with their parents. In some ways, you know, in this dazzling kind of alternate reality, it can be harder to find your place because everything's taken care of for you. You don't really have to take responsibility for the consequences of your actions, which is how a guy like Tom could end up stealing a time machine and screwing it all up because he doesn't think through the consequences of his actions. He's never had to. Here, it's different. I mean, you know, most of the book actually takes place in our world, in the real world, with this Tom from another reality kind of, you know, caught in the wrong version of today. But what I wanted to do was to start, you know, once you move beyond that initial idea that we are living in the dystopia, to start peeling that back. I'm interested in questions like, how much of who you are is just your core, it's just intrinsic to you, and how much of it is circumstance, you know, where you grow up, what your parents do, you know, the kind of job you get, when you graduate high school or college, the people who you meet, you know, the person you decide to connect yourself to romantically or emotionally. I was interested in kind of peeling back the layers of this, not just the main character, but the people in his life to say, how could they have ended up differently? You know, what is the core that carries them through, and how much of who they are is the result of circumstances? Because I think those are really interesting questions. And it allowed me to kind of write a book that, you know, dealt with a lot of really big ideas and had all these fun plot twists and kind of like swerves and character revelations, but fundamentally was about just a basic human thing, which is like, what makes you, you? And so I wanted Tom to be able to see his mother in a new light, see his father in a new light, see, you know, Penny, who he knew in the other world as Penelope, you know, in a different light, and to see himself in a different light. And in some ways, part of what I'm trying to do, I mean, I'm trying to tell a great story that explores all these what-ifs, and I'm also kind of trying to chart his emotional growth. You know, one of the things about becoming a grown-up yourself is you start to see your parents as grown-ups. They don't exist, you know, frozen in amber like the mosquito in Jurassic Park, right? They're people. And just like you, the person who your parents are is the result of a bunch of choices they made and the consequences of those choices, and they could have made other choices. I think about myself. I mean, here I am talking to you. My parents met in a coffee shop in Jerusalem. Now, neither of my parents are from Israel. My father was born in Morocco, in Marrakesh. My mom was born in Chicago. She was living in London, in England, in the late 60s. And she was, you know, she ended up traveling through Israel. My father had moved there and had become a lawyer. And there was a coffee shop underneath his law office. And my mother was walking down the street, and she was hungry, and she went into this coffee shop, and he was just leaving, and they met in the doorway. And if he had left a minute earlier, or she'd come in a minute later, they wouldn't have met, because they came from different continents. They had completely different lives. It was happenstance, and yet here I am. And so I think about all those choices we make in life, the little hinge, which we don't think of them as, you know, when my mother was walking down the street and decided to try this coffee shop because she was hungry, she didn't think that she would meet the man she would marry, the father of her children. She didn't think her life was going to go off in a completely different direction. And I assure you, when my father went down for lunch that day, he didn't think that he was going to meet a woman who would get him to move to another continent. You know, he didn't speak a word of English when he came to Canada because my mother wanted to do her PhD. You know, the only word of English he could speak on their wedding was the word hello. And here he was turning his back on a prosperous legal career in another country. So, I mean, why am I telling you all this biographical detail? Because I think about that a lot, how these little tiny decisions we make can have massive ramifications, which is why, of course, time travel is this sort of enduring topic, you know, this idea that we can go back and revisit our decisions. You know, most time travel stories are stories about regret. They're about second chances. And I think that's a very human thing. And so even though, you know, I love telling a book that's like moves really fast and is a real page turner and has all these crazy plot twists, also it's fundamentally a story about the things we do to try to fix our mistakes.
Thinking about all of the minutiae that determine our current timeline, how is it that our minds are not blown? And how long have you been thinking about parallel worlds?
I mean, I think it's been a thing that interested me since I was a kid. You know, I mean, like, yeah, I love these kind of stories. I mean, you know, I had a movie called What If that starred Daniel Radcliffe that was in theaters back in 2014. I mean, those questions, I'm always asking those kinds of questions and thinking about how things could have played out differently. I love stories of parallel worlds because we have this tendency to think of the way things are as the way they had to be. But there are hinge points, you know. Sometimes they're elections, you know. Sometimes they're, some sort of geopolitical thing. Sometimes they're personal, these little hinges that kind of where our life could go one way or another. And so, you know, but having said that, you know, these ideas are just ideas. To me, a story is worth telling. A novel, something as big as a novel, is worth writing when you have the characters to tell the story about. So for me, it's like, yes, I've been fascinated by this stuff for my whole life, since I was a kid. But what I really, you know, what really made me want to write this book was that I figured out who these people were, and then I had a story to tell about these characters using these ideas. Because, I don't know, I think that, like, it's great. Like, you know, you hear what a book's about, you're like, oh, that sounds interesting. But what makes you fall in love with a book is that you fall in love with the characters. And so that's what I wanted. I wanted a story where hopefully the reader would maybe be drawn in by the cool ideas, and but they would stay because they love the characters as much as I do.
Do you believe that ideas float around waiting for people to realize them?
Yes, totally. I do. You know, I mean, I talk about that in the book. But where do ideas come from? Where does creative inspiration come from? You know, and I do think that, they float out there. I think that people can have the same idea because if they have the same influences, it's sort of like, I think ideas float around, and sometimes you're in the right place at the right time to kind of pluck it. You know, I even think about writing this book. I'm working as a screenwriter. You know, I tend to write movies, and I had this idea kind of kicking around in my head for a long time, but I could never really figure it out how to tell the story, and I wasn't sure if it was even a story that I would be able to tell. One day, I'm walking my dog down the street. I have a dog. Her name's Ruby Slippers. She's adorable, and I'm walking her to the beach, and it suddenly pops into my head that I could tell this story as a memoir, as if I could write it as a first person memoir, this character Tom telling you, the reader, what happened to him in his own words. And it suddenly occurred to me that I could do that as a novel. And I just sat there, I was walking by a bench, and I sat down on the bench, and I just took out my phone, and I just started typing out the first chapter of the book. And if you pick up the book at a bookstore or download it, whatever device you use, the first chapter of the book is almost word for word what I wrote when I sat down there that day on the bench while my dog was kind of whining and pulling on the leash because she's like, why are you just sitting here? We're supposed to be going to the beach. But I sat there and tapped out just that first little chapter. And I think to myself, like, well, what if that idea hadn't popped into my head? What if I had decided not to walk my dog at just that moment? Like, would I have ever started writing this book? Now, maybe I would have. Maybe the next day I would have had the idea. Or maybe it would have taken me 2 years to have the idea. Or maybe somebody else would have had the idea. And I mean, you know, on the one hand, this story is the version of the story that only I could tell because it comes from my perspective. Another writer could take this exact idea and come up with a completely other book. But yeah, I mean, I think about these sort of ideas that float out and around in the world. And I feel like no idea is ever lost, you know, like even if you could have an idea and not write it down, and maybe somebody else will have it. Because I think there's a sort of a collective consciousness that we're all part of, and sometimes we kind of connect to it and sometimes we don't.
Parts of your utopian parallel timeline give a nod to the timeline we're experiencing, like the end of the physical book or the fact that handwriting is not considered an essential skill to teach in schools. Are these warnings that should be heeded?
I think so. I mean, warning is maybe strong because I'm not trying to be moralizing about it. I'm trying, sort of in the tradition of Kurt Vonnegut, to sort of look at our world with objectivity, with a sense of humor, and sometimes with a critical eye, but to say, like, what are we doing? Where are we going? Is this where we want to be going? You know, if this is where we want to be going, okay. But if this isn't, then let's slow things down and think about it. So, yeah, I mean, is our world going to be significantly damaged without handwriting? I don't know. That's a very interesting question, isn't it? What does your handwriting say about you? What is the experience of reading a letter written in a person's unique handwriting? How is that different than an email? You know, my mother, not to get overly personal, but my mother passed away very suddenly about 16 years ago. And I have emails from her, that I kept. But recently I was at my father's place and I was looking for a book that was in a box and my old stuff. And I found a different book and I opened it and I realized it was actually a book that my mother had given to me and she'd inscribed it. And I hadn't looked at it in years and years and years. And just seeing her handwriting had this profound emotional impact on me. You know, I mean, losing my mother, I was 26 when she died. Obviously it was, a terrible time and very sad and very dismaying and it was very hard on my family. But, you know, it was 16 years ago and, you know, I've grown and I've developed and I've had a whole other life since then. But just seeing a few lines inscribed in her handwriting had such a powerful effect. And so when we lose handwriting, it's not just how we communicate and, whether typing everything, we're losing something or gaining something or whatever. It's also like that experience, the emotional experience of seeing your mother's handwriting 16 years after she died and knowing only she could have written those words exactly that way. I mean, that's, you know, it was sad when it happened, but that doesn't mean it's not an experience worth keeping. So I think about that kind of stuff, not just the bigger picture, how is it affecting society, but what emotional experiences are we giving up?
You mentioned just now Kurt Vonnegut, and his book Cat's Cradle is mentioned in your book. And your character says, it appeared in this parallel universe because it was published in 1963 and this event that changed the future didn't happen until 1965. And you mentioned that, if you haven't read it, you should read it. So I went to the library. I'm embarrassed to say I've never read Kurt Vonnegut. He's been on my list for years, but I've never read him. So I went to the library and I got a copy of Cat's Cradle and I'm holding it right here, but I have not read it. Should I go back and read? Does it play a significant role on this book? Should I go back and read it and then listen to your audio version? I'm just curious.
Well, I definitely encourage you to read Kurt Vonnegut. I think he's a terrific writer. I think he's one of the great humorists in American literature. I think he plays his genre in a way that's so delightful. People think of him as writing sci-fi sci-fi, but not really. I mean, he's more in the Mark Twain tradition of using certain genre conventions, because fundamentally he's a humanist, you know. He's writing about humanity with as much... He's not letting us off the hook, you know. He is both compassionate to humans, but also critical of the choices that they make and their constant blunders. So, I mean, I would encourage you to read it. But at the same time, you're not gonna miss anything in my book if you haven't read Cat's Cradle. For me, it was more... You know, I started writing this book on evenings and weekends, on the side. You know, like a lot of first-time novelists, I had a day job. Now, I mean, for me, my day job was writing movies. I work as a screenwriter, so obviously that's an uncommon day job. But it's still, you know, I have contracts, I have deadlines, I have expectations. It wasn't like I had 6 months to just take off and write a novel. So I was writing it just on evenings and weekends, a little bit at a time. And I started writing these very short chapters, for the specific reason that each chapter reflected one day's work. You know, I would take an hour of my day or my evening, and I'd write just a little short chapter. But I started to really like the short chapters, and if you read the book, you'll see it has these very short chapters, which I think create a sense of pace and momentum. I think it makes it kind of more of a page-turner. But I realized as I was sort of five or six, maybe seven chapters in, that it reminded me of Cat's Cradle, which has very short chapters. And even though I hadn't been inspired by it when I started, I went back and looked at it, and I realized a lot of the themes of Cat's Cradle are similar to the themes that I'm exploring, particularly that idea that technology has unforeseen consequences, that what I call the accident. Anytime you invent a new technology, you also invent the accident of that technology. There's no such thing as a car crash until you invent the car. There's no such thing as a plane crash until you invent the plane. So every time we introduce a new technology, we also invent the unintended consequence of that technology, the accident. And so I wanted to sort of pay homage to Vonnegut, even though I hadn't intended to kind of be referencing him at first. I realized his influence was there, and so I might as well acknowledge it. And then the idea that Cat's Cradle would be one of these characters' sort of favorite novel and would have influenced them, it just seemed like it felt right to me. And it gave me a chance to kind of pay homage to the master without being too kind of cloying, and also just acknowledging his influence on me, again, without overdoing it. I mean, it's not like if you read Cat's Cradle, you're not going to get more out of my novel. I think you'll have the same experience. But if you like Cat's Cradle, you'll sort of get a little extra boost.
Now, you mentioned your background in writing and producing movies. You wrote and produced Alone in the Dark, The Samaritan, and What If? Am I missing any?
Yeah, I mean, I did a couple other. I did a kids movie called MVP2, and I did a little indie movie called Skate Life. But yeah, those are, you know, I mean, the most recent one was What If? With Dan Radcliffe and Zoe Kazan and Adam Driver. Came out in 2014.
Okay. So how is this different, or how is this process different for you, the book versus the movie?
I mean, on the one hand, it's still just writing, but, you know, movies are a very collaborative medium. You are writing, and also, it's like an architect designing a building. The blueprint is not the building, right? That's what a screenplay is like. It's like you're like a composer writing a symphony, but it's not the same thing as listening to the orchestra play it. And so you're collaborating with a director, with crew, with actors who are going to take your work and translate it. There's no direct connection with the reader. You know, you don't go to a movie theater and see script pages projected onto the screen. That would be a very boring movie. And so the direct connection of my words with the reader, that's very different. Now, there's more responsibility in a lot of ways because I can't just hand the script over and let somebody else bring it to life. My collaboration isn't with a director or actors or producer. My collaboration is with the reader. You know, I'm trying to create essentially like a movie in their minds when they're reading it. So it's sort of more vulnerable for me as a writer, but also the freedom of having access to all these literary tools and literary techniques. A screenplay is written in a very specific form. Screenplays are always in the third person. They're written in the present tense. They're very visually like vivid, but it's a very laconic, very lean writing style. So being able to write a novel where you have, first of all, just being able to write in the first person, having access to the interior thoughts of the character, being able to use different literary tricks and techniques, it was very liberating and very fun. At the same time, you don't want to overdo it. Like, you're still, you know, telling a story to a reader, and you don't want to be indulgent. So, you know, in a screenplay, every word matters, and in a novel, every word matters. You know, that's just what writing is. And so, you know, like I say, you try to follow Kurt Vonnegut's maxim, which is you just never waste the reader's time.
Most writers deal with one timeline to manage, and you had at least four or five that I can recall. How did you keep track of all of your characters and all of your worlds?
Well, I used an ancient and storied technique called rewriting. What you're reading is not my first draft. So, yeah, I'm juggling a lot. But my job as a writer, working with my editors as well, is to make sure that I'm taking the reader through the story as smoothly as possible, not losing them. So I just rewriting. It's a very basic answer. I just kept rewriting and rewriting until it felt as clear as possible.
Is this the life you're supposed to have?
That's a great question. I mean, I don't think there is such thing as the life we're supposed to have. There's the life you do have. I mean, none of us are living the exact perfect life. I am a very fortunate person. You know, I've been able to make a living as a writer. I have my first novel coming out. I'm sitting here talking to you about it. It means that at least some people are interested in it. The reviews have been great, all that stuff. I mean, I feel so lucky. I have a wonderful wife. I have two kids. I live a good life. And I'm very grateful for that. It could have gone a lot of ways, and it's not over. You know, I mean, my mom died when she was 55, way too early, way too fast. I am always aware that I'm making the decisions about what kind of life I'm going to have every day. And it's not just about the big picture, what my job is, where I live. It's how I treat people, you know, how I treat the people in my life who are most important to me, how I treat strangers. I mean, you know, the people that you run into every day. So am I living the life I'm supposed to have? I'm doing my best. You know, I'm trying to make the right choices. I'm trying to take responsibility for the consequences of my choices. But none of us are living the life that we thought we were going to have. Even if you're happy, which I hope you are, even if you're satisfied, which I hope you are, it probably didn't turn out the way you thought it was going to. And that's what my character's going through as well. I mean, yeah, he's not living the life he thinks he's supposed to have. In either version of the world, what he has to learn to embrace is the life he does have. And that's what we all have to do.
I thought it was excruciating the way he had to go back in time in the way Lionel sent him back in time. And it
right.
was just in reverse, but, not like warp speed.
Yeah. Well, that was a choice that I made, which is that, you know, in Tom's version of the world, it is superficially a utopia. You know, technology solves so many problems, like humanity is in a really good place. But everything's easy. And that's not, you know, when things are hard in your life, having things be easy hardly seems like a problem, right? I mean, we should all be so lucky that life is easy for us. But part of that is even time travel in his world is easy. You know, the time machine works, you appear where you want to be, and it's very simple. And I wanted, even in our world, when it comes to our world, and it's messy, and it's complicated, and it's not black and white, it's all shades of gray, and he doesn't know what to do a lot of the time. There's no easy answer. I wanted even time travel to be complicated. You know, I wanted even time travel to be a lot messier. Why should going back in time be easy? Why shouldn't it be like an existential horror show? You know, why shouldn't it be the hardest thing you've ever gone through to go back in time? Why should that be simple? And so I like the idea of setting both the character and the reader up for this surprise, which is that, no, this is a big decision. Going back in time should not be done capriciously. The first time you went back in time, you didn't think about the consequences, and look what happened. Now you know what the consequences are, so why should anybody make it easy for you? Why should going back in time not be the hardest thing you've ever experienced? And that's what it is. So I like to make those kind of decisions because anytime you can use the character's own assumptions against them to make a more interesting and compelling story for the reader, you know you're in a good place as a writer.
I really liked the way Tom started taking on the characteristics of John or Victor, toward the end of the book. And, you know, the first part he was a doofus. He was, but then he just started gathering the best parts of himself in the different universes. And I just liked the way he came together as a character at the end.
Oh, thank you for saying that. Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's what we're all trying to do in life, right? Like, you are trying to be a collection of the best things about yourself. We're not always, and when we go through crises in our lives, it's very easy to have the worst parts of yourselves come out. So I like the idea of telling a story that turned out to be about how to become a grown-up. That's not what you think it's going to be about when you start the book. I mean, there's, you know, technology and time travel and plot twists and big reveals, but in the end of the story, it's about how to take responsibility for your actions and just be an adult.
That was Elan Mastai, author of All Our Wrong Todays, which was published by Dutton. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover new episodes at KMUW.org or through iTunes. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our editor is Luann Stevens. Our engineer is John Cyphers, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.